You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 19th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, my friends. How are you?
Anything new in your lives?
I mean, you can't, Steve, can't leave the floor open like that for me because I'm going to talk about my son.
What's he doing this week?
His pseudo-talking, the babble thing, is happening quite a bit, and it's so adorable. Oh my God, it's epic.
Yeah, it gets cute when they start to babble like their proto-language.
And he's so skeptical, it's ridiculous.
Oh, he is.
He better be.
So what you should do, Jay, is for the bedtime story, you should read him the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems.
I'll get right on that.
Is this a segue?
What a strange thing to suggest one read a baby. Especially considering that that book was placed on the index of forbidden books not too long ago.
Not too long ago?
Oh, hey, happy publishing of dialogue concerning the two chief world systems day, everybody.
Yay.
On February 22nd, 1632, Galileo delivered his manuscript for dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, as it is known, to his patron, Medici. And if you're not aware, this was the book that did, in fact, get Galileo busted by the authorities for grave suspicion of heresy, which led to his house arrest, which he was under until he died. And it was all because he wrote this book that some say is slightly in favor of a heliocentric solar system, as opposed to a system in which the Earth remains at the center of everything and does not move. He couched it as best he could. You gotta give him credit for that. Instead of just coming out and writing a full reasoned book on why, obviously, the Earth is moving around the sun and not vice versa, he created basically this dialogue between several parties, on one side arguing for the idea that the Earth goes around the sun, and on the other side arguing that the sun goes around the Earth. The party that was arguing that the Earth goes around the sun, though, was pretty obviously the winner in this dialogue. Mm-hmm. He even named the party that believed that the Earth was the center of the universe, was called Simplicio.
So as simpleton.
He says that he named him after another philosopher, who was known at the time, but yeah, it didn't look good. And considering that Simplicio was the loser of the dialogue, it also wasn't good that Galileo used the Pope's words in his argument, which was then defeated, because the Pope had been a supporter of Galileo, and after that, the Pope thought that people were making fun of him, and he got a little peeved about that. Galileo, on his part, claimed that he did not mean to cause any offense to the Pope, but it was too late. He went on trial. It did not go well. He was forced to recant his beliefs, and yeah, placed under house arrest. And the book was banned. And also, any other, publication that Galileo had put out was also banned at that point. So yeah, things didn't go so well for him for simply presenting the scientific argument.
Mm-hmm. I actually took a full college course on this book.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Wow.
It was really fascinating. Yeah.
Would you read it? Did you get a B?
Of course.
Of course.
And, you know, and other stuff about Galileo, but it really focused on this book. So it, what's interesting, I got to give you a couple little tidbits about it. So
yeah.
Galileo's main arguments were all correct. I mean, he went, or mostly, there were two major flaws with the book. He counteracted arguments like, you know, if you drop something on the surface of the Earth, why doesn't it fly to the west, you know? And he essentially described the whole notion of frames of reference. Like if you're inside a ship and you drop something, it falls straight down. So even you can't tell if the ship is moving smoothly, you know, at a uniform rate, or if it's docked, you know, if it's stopped in the dock.
Shades of Einstein.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little foreshadowing.
And He also deconstructed the competing philosophy, showing that, you know, there are mountains on the moon, you know, Galileo's famous discovery of the moons of Jupiter, proving that there are objects that revolve around something other than the Earth. But here are the two very interesting flaws. So Galileo correctly argued for why what we observed was consistent with a sun-centered solar system, but he wanted there to be evidence for the fact that the Earth was moving. And he had a theory as to how the Earth's movement caused the tides. And that was just wrong. That piece of his argument was just incorrect.
Which is funny because while he was writing the book, apparently, he had called it Dialogue on the Tides.
Mm-hmm.
It went to the Inquisition first, apparently, and they had to grant the title approval. And at that point, it was called Dialogue on the Ebb and Flow of the Sea. But he was asked to remove all mention of the tides because apparently that if they had allowed the book to be published with that title, it would have looked as though it was an approval of his theory on the tides. So instead it was named, it just went apparently under the title Dialogue. And it was only much later that it gathered the name Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, which was given to it by, I think, a theologian who was attempting to give it a very balanced sort of title.
The other main criticism is that Galileo did not even discuss Tycho Brahe's alternate system, which was that all the planets revolve about the sun, but Mercury and Venus revolve in small circles about the sun, and the outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, revolve about the Earth and the sun, but that the sun goes around the Earth. Do you picture that? So that was as consistent with the observations of the time as was the Copernican system of the sun at the center and the Earth going around the sun. So at the time, Galileo really couldn't put an argument forward for why the Copernican system should be preferred over the Tychonian system. He could say that the
that the
Copernican system was you know, philosophically, scientifically possible, and that it was equivalent, but he couldn't prove that the Earth was in fact moving. So, you know, Foucault's pendulum, mm-hmm, that was the experiment that proved that the Earth was in fact moving, and we required later observations that didn't come for 100 years or so
more rotation though than real like orbital motion. Right?
Well, the one difference between the Copernican system and the Tychonian system, other than the fact that the Earth is moving, was stellar parallax. And at the time of Galileo, there was no observation demonstrating stellar parallax. That's basically the stars, nearby stars moving with respect to the background stars as the Earth goes around the sun. But observations demonstrating stellar parallax did not exist until the 19th century. So that, you know, did confirm, you know, the Copernican system and Galileo's predictions, but they weren't contemporary to Galileo, which is interesting. All right, let's move on to some news items. Jay, you're going to at least partially debunk a very old myth about the murder of Kitty Genovese.
So, right, Steve, yeah, this is a long story, so I'm going to condense it as best I can, but I think a lot of people will find this interesting because this happens to be something that a lot of us have in our heads and the information is wrong. So the backstory is on March 13th, 1964, around 3:15 in the morning, a 28-year-old Kitty Genovese was on her way home after working at a bar in Queens, New York, and she lived in a neighborhood called Kew Gardens. And unfortunately for Kitty, there was a absolutely horrible murder rapist literally looking for his next victim, Winston Mosley. And he was prowling very close nearby. Then he ended up spotting Kitty. He stabbed her twice. He quickly retreated after hearing a neighbor yell down at the commotion. The neighbor wasn't quite sure what he had saw, but he looked like a woman may have been in a somewhat threatening situation. So the guy yelled down. But Mosley soon came back to the wounded Kitty and he stabbed her several more times and he raped her. He left her for dead, but she wasn't actually dead. And she soon, of course, died in the arms of one of her neighbors. So the story became a legend around the world, and it's not because of the fact that it was this horrible rape murder. And unfortunately for today, you know, in today's world, like, these types of things happen enough where it's not even, you know, you hear it and you're not surprised. But because of the then police commissioner, Michael Murphy, who irresponsibly leaked information to a New York Times editor named Abe Rosenthal, this story kind of went crazy. And what happened that time during their lunch conversation was the police commissioner casually said over that lunch that 38 eyewitnesses saw the crime, saw this particular murder, and they didn't do anything about it. And he put it in such a way where Rosenthal believed at the time that, that they were literally perched in their windows watching the entire event unfold for its, you know, from beginning to end, and they just were happy to observe it, and they weren't willing to raise a finger to help in any way. About 10 days later, the New York Times had a front page article that started with, "For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens." First, there was a factual error in that statement. There was only two attacks made, although that's not incredibly significant to the story. It's important to note that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation going on in this story. So this began a media frenzy that further contorted the story until New York City was vilified as a city filled with people who not only don't care about their neighbors, but, you know, it was thought to be a lawless city that everyone there, it was like hell on earth. That's one way it was described. The entire world read stories that were being regurgitated by all of the news outlets all over the world. And it was thought that this event sparked the end of decency in the civilized world, or that's the way it was reported. The facts are that most of the neighbors had little information on what was actually going on. Those who saw any of it were still not clear on what was exactly happening. It wasn't like anyone was 100% sure at all, or even close to that, that this woman was being raped and murdered. It just looked like there was a commotion going on to what is believed to be maybe 16 people actually laid eyes on one or more of the situation that was going on the street. The police were called by neighbors and they didn't respond. One neighbor actually put herself in harm's way and ended up holding Kitty as she bled to death in one of the foyers, like that, you know, like the alcove foyer outside. And she entered the crime scene very soon after Mosley departed. So she could have been actually walking onto the scene as far as she knew. She just knew that something was going on and she wanted to go out and help. Now, these events were not known to the public because everyone sadly loved the alternative story, which is the wrong story. And it's a story about apathetic neighbors who only care about the events that were happening, and they were supposedly watching them like a movie.
What's interesting, Jay, is that, you know, this, you know, as you're saying, that there was a narrative and people went with the narrative and didn't question the facts. But this has played out multiple times since then. You guys remember the Duke rape case?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, what ends up happening is that the media and the pundits start speculating about what this means for society rather than questioning, is it actually happen? One of the interesting things I read was that this was like, you know, this is 1964. There was a lot of speculation that this was partly the result of TV, that, you know, people were used to being spectators and watching stuff happen on their TV. And so they were basically sitting by their window watching this rape murder as if they were watching a TV program. They were just sort of numbed into, you know, apathy and inactivity. You know, but it's kind of a naive kind of, you know, psychological speculation about this newfangled technology, that TVs that were, you know, destroying the moral fabric of society.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at a story like this or stories that are similar to this one, and the narrative that gets created on the spot gets picked up and people really only want to believe that or seem to be only interested in that narrative. Where there was actually a real story going on here that in a lot of ways could have made the neighborhood look good instead of bad. You know, I thought that some people acted commendably in this situation. But unfortunately, you know, with confirmation bias turned up to, you know, 100%, as soon as people hear the type of thing that they want to hear, they just latch onto it. And sadly, what was going on in the world at the time, sure, things were down. The United States in particular wasn't doing well. I mean, Kennedy was murdered 4 months prior to this. There were, you know, worsening racial tensions going on in Harlem, not too far from Queens. Guys, you know, which one of you has heard this story, maybe not knowing the person's name or knowing anything other than the fact that a bunch of neighbors watched somebody get raped and murdered? I remember hearing it, and I knew this story very well. I fully believed this up until 2 days ago.
Wow.
Yeah, this is the story that you hear every time another psychologist does a study on the bystander effect. Every single time it seems to come back to Kitty Genovese. And what's interesting, though, is that the origin story is not what everyone thought it was. Does that throw a new light on all of these studies that have come up after this, purporting to actually show that the bystander effect is real? I mean, you can't completely dismiss all of the studies, but maybe we should be taking a more critical look at them. I don't know.
I agree. Sure. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of research has been done. I mean, psychiatrists and psychologists went nuts after this. That's a funny way to put it, but they did a lot of testing. They did a lot of speculating. A lot of articles and books were written in response to this murder. You know, anything to do with human psychology, everything is so subjective. Everything is so, you know, it's difficult to say this is the exact way that people are going to behave. You know, maybe this crowd of 38 people or 36 people are going to act this way, and a crowd in another part of the country or the world or whatever would act completely differently. Who knows?
But to clarify, I mean, the number 38 is wrong. I mean, that was a misinterpretation of the record, and probably the chief of police there were 38 entries in the eyewitness record, but they were not individual interviews. So that number is just made up. It doesn't reflect reality. Very few of the people in the area were in a position to see the second and fatal attack. Most people, again, this is 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, a lot of the neighbors were elderly. So imagine getting woken up out of your sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning by some noises outside. A lot of people figured it was just a drunk, or it was a fight, you know, a lover spat, or they didn't even get aroused by it, or, you know, some people may have seen her staggering after the first attack, but not seen the second attack. The second attack took place in a location that very few people could have seen. But you should mention also, Jay, there are two people in this story who did behave very badly.
Absolutely.
I think, well, we saw the full range of some people doing everything they could, some people just not being sure what to do, some people being scumbags. You know, it's basically the full range of human reaction that you would expect, not a consistent 38 eyewitnesses peering out their window and doing nothing as this attack took place.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the people that could have gotten involved, that knew enough of what was going on, who, you know, fearfully hid in the back of his apartment with his bottle of vodka, he coined the phrase, "I didn't want to get involved." Maybe, of course, somebody else probably said that, but that's what made that statement popular. And
this story makes me think of a recent news item. I mean, have you guys heard about the Ethiopian pilot who flew a plane to Switzerland? It was on its way to France, but the co-pilot basically took control of the plane while the pilot was in the bathroom before takeoff. And he took off and basically just flew the plane to Switzerland so that he could try to get amnesty and escape Ethiopia. And the news reports at first were reporting that none of the passengers knew that the plane was being abducted, basically. But passengers have made it clear otherwise. They said that the co-pilot announced that he was cutting off the oxygen in the plane. And so they sat there for like 6 hours thinking that they were all going to die. And my first thought was like, wow, you know, post 9/11, you would think that they would all get together and storm the cockpit somehow. But I read an AMA on Reddit with one of the passengers on the plane, and the situation just becomes so complex because the pilot was there on the other side of the door talking to the co-pilot and being reassured that he was going to land the plane safely. And, you know, there are all these moving parts that when it gets down to it, like a real life situation is so much more complicated than just well, it was the bystander effect. Everybody just hoped somebody else would do something. Yep. It's not quite so simple as I think we kind of want it to believe, because, and I think a part of that is us wishing that, well, if I were in the same situation, I would do something different. I would step up and I would actually, you know, do something, even if it resulted in my death. But the truth of the matter is that it's just not that simple. You know, it's not that simple.
Right.
That's what that is something that though is very consistent in the psychological research, is that people's predictions about how they will behave in a situation are not very accurate to the way people actually behave. You know, everyone thinks they're the exception, you know, but obviously most of us have to be wrong.
Right.
But you're right. That's the bottom line, is that the situation is always more complicated than the simplistic moralizing narrative that emerges and that gets spread around. Well, let's move on. Evan, you're going to tell, this is another sad case. This is a case of pseudoscientific vandalism.
Yeah, it is. But the question is, I pose to you, listeners, and to my friends here on the show, how far will you go to support your deepest held beliefs? So let's say.
Six.
Yes. Let's say for a minute that you have this belief, right? That technologies and religions of many people in the ancient civilizations were given to them by extraterrestrial beings who were welcomed as gods at the time, right? Let's also say that artifacts were left behind by these extraterrestrials, including things like Stonehenge in Britain and the Moai humanoid statues of Easter Island or the Nazca lines in Peru, which are supposedly landing strips for extraterrestrial vehicles. And of course, perhaps most famously, the pyramids of Egypt, right? How far will you go to support your beliefs that these things are fact? Would you, for example, gain access by any means to the inner chambers of the Great Pyramid of Giza, and which is a place that's usually reserved for Egyptologists and archaeologists? Would you vandalize and steal some artifacts and conduct your own tests on the materials in an attempt to validate your personal belief system? Well, if you said no, then good for you. You actually have respect for property and you have some modicum of self-control. If you said yes, well, then you'd probably get along quite fine with a pair of chuckleheads from Germany who did just that. Gained unlawful access to the inner chambers of the pyramids of Giza. They vandalized the site. They stole artifacts in an attempt to prove to the world that extraterrestrials built the pyramids over 20,000 years ago, or at least they gave the locals the knowledge on how to build the pyramids 20,000 years ago, despite all scientific evidence to the contrary.
They're saying it's not just aliens, but they make a connection to Atlantis. The people from Atlantis built the pyramids, even though Atlantis doesn't exist
yet. Right. Atlantis is a tale created by Plato.
Plato, yeah.
So let's give a hat tip to Ben Radford for publishing an article this week at LiveScience.com about this very story. According to the press release from the Ministry of State for Antiquities in Egypt, amateur archaeologists Dominique Gerlitz and Stefan Erdmann, they are accused of having stolen samples of a cartouche of Khufu from a small room on top of the king's burial chamber inside the Great Pyramid. In addition, they're accused of damaging the World Heritage Monument and stealing and smuggling parts of it. Apparently, Gerlitz and Erdmann scraped away some ancient writing to prove that the Great Pyramids are 20,000 years old. And how were they caught? Well, they weren't caught red-handed at the time of the trespass or the vandalism and theft. Nope. They were caught because these two clever folks recorded themselves gaining access to the chambers, documented all their activities on video, and put it up on YouTube and other places. And the title of their show was called The Cheops Project. Right.
Yeah, though they had a cameraman with them. There was a third gentleman with them, yeah.
Correct, right. Who is one of the people who's in big trouble for participating in this. Now, if you go to their one of their sites in which they talk about their activities, they describe exactly what their documentary is about. They say in 1837, the British pyramid researcher Howard Weiss discovered hieroglyphs and the cartridge of Cheops in the reliving chambers of the Great Pyramid that prove him as the principal. This is Cheops. The authenticity of the cartridge has been a contentious point for a long time. While Egyptologists are confident on the authenticity of the cartridge, Weiss very quickly came under suspicion to have faked it himself so he could claim the sensational discovery for himself. And if this could be proven, then a lot of questions would be added to the speculations on the builders of the Giza pyramids. So that's their stated position as to, you know.
Evan, you're calling it a cartridge. Is that just the translation of the word cartouche?
I don't know. I don't know.
I think this is a German site translated into English.
Is that what that is? Okay.
So I know what a cartouche is. I've never heard of a cartridge. I don't know. That's why I just assumed that was just a loose translation of the word cartouche, but I'm not sure. We need an Egyptologist to tell us.
And they wanted to determine the cartouche's authenticity by using a new examination and dating method. And a sample of the cartouche was actually taken out of country and is now in a laboratory in Germany undergoing analysis, supposedly. So a total of three Germans, there's the two guys and their cameraman, and along with six Egyptians are being held in connection with the case. Although I don't think they actually have the two guys. I think they fled. Or the Germans are not in country, but they're wanted. But the folks in Egypt who apparently allowed this to happen, including several guards and inspectors from the antiquities mystery, who apparently gave these people the access to the pyramid, they're being held, and this is a big to-do. It's a big problem.
I mean, the big problem here is that they're making an end run around the process of science, you know, which exists for a reason. If they have a case to be made, then they should make it. They should do the scholarship, publish the papers, have it be reviewed by other experts. And if they don't have to necessarily convince the community that they're right, but they should at least make a compelling enough case that they would be given access to, or at least, you know, that they would, they're claiming that, again, these inscriptions do not date to the time the pyramids were built, but to only a couple hundred years ago. If they could make that case sufficiently convincingly, then that could force a transparent dating, you know, of those writings. But by doing it the way they did it, first of all, they haven't earned the right to get access to these artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're essentially stealing them. They're not doing it with any kind of transparency or legitimacy. So who cares? I mean, if they claim that whatever lab they gave this, who knows who they gave it to, and, you know, would some legitimate lab do this kind of an experiment on essentially stolen, you know, ill-gotten goods, no one's going to believe the results. So this whole endeavor is doomed to failure from the beginning because there's no proper process and transparency to it. You know, you can't steal evidence and then publish results about it. You know what I mean?
And you're right. It's basically, you know, doing, like you said, doing an end round around the, you know, legitimate, pursuit of science in this regard.
And they're wrong. You know, and their ideas are nonsensical. That's why nobody would listen to them.
Plus there's that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is true. That is true. By the way, if you want to read some good stuff about this, there's a website called A Hot Cup of Joe, Archaeology, Anthropology, Science, and Skepticism. They have written about this and have brought up some really good points. Such as when these guys went in there to scrape away the pigment samples, basically pointed out that, look, the pigment isn't going to reveal what you're looking for, right? It's pigment is difficult to date. They say that you don't really date the pigment. Instead, what you wind up doing is you get enough of a sample, you separate the pigment from the binder and emulsifier and hope that those binders and emulsifiers are organic, and that's what you can date.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, they're saying the Egyptians didn't build the pyramids, but there's a archaeological record showing that they did. You know, there were, as Kenny Fader pointed out on our show when we interviewed him about this, you know, there are documentations of the development, the evolution of their techniques of failed pyramids before that they learned how to build them. It's all documented. It's not like they just pop out of nowhere. You know, it's ridiculous.
Which is similar to technology today. People say that, you know, they have this, this invention or whatever. And you're like, whoa, you know, you're just making 30 or 40 steps that ahead. You're just leaping ahead. You know, where's the intermediary steps that are generally required for something like that? And the evidence is there. If you look at, you know, the development of technology, you could see the progression. And I remember one picture, Steve, of one pyramid, and clearly the angle was too steep, and I think the thing just collapsed in on itself.
Right.
Like, whoops,
right,
okay, right. We learned our lesson here. Let's do it again over here. And you can just see the progression. It's beautiful.
Exactly, exactly. They just ignore all that. So these guys, Gurlitz and Erdman, are definitely in the running for the pseudoscientific jackass of the week. But they have stiff competition from this next news item. Have you guys heard about the whole Subway sandwich kerfuffle about the Subway is, you know, adding a chemical to their bread and
a food blocker? My daughter even brought it up to me the other day. You know, they're talking about it in school.
What were they saying about it?
That it's very bad and that people should not be eating the Subway sandwiches until Subway corrects the problem and takes this chemical out of their bread.
Yeah, it's total bullshit. Here we go. So the Food Babe is a blogger. Her name is Very Hairy, but she blogs under the Food Babe. Started a petition to get Subway to remove the use of the chemical azotocarbonamide from their breads. This is a chemical that is used to make bread sort of fluffier and as a preservative and as a bleaching agent. It certainly isn't absolutely necessary, but it's used to by not just Subway, but actually lots of, like, I think McDonald's uses it, lots of places use it. The Food Babe makes the following claims about this chemical. She writes, azotocarbonamide is the same chemical used to make yoga mats, shoe soles, and other rubbery objects. It's not supposed to be in food or even eaten for that matter, and it's definitely not fresh. So she's arguing that because this chemical is used in the manufacture of things like yoga mats, that it's somehow, like, that's supposed to make it seem like it's not really food. Like, there's rubber in these sandwiches and these breads, which is not accurate. So this is, I'd liken this to the dihydrogen monoxide parody. You guys, for those listeners who may not have heard this, just go to the website dihydrogen monoxide, and read about how awful this substance is. I mean, it's the major component of acid rain. If you breathe this in enough of it, it will kill you. It's a really toxic, horrible substance. All right. When you're done reading about that, dihydrogen monoxide, of course, is water, is H2O. But the purpose of the parody, which is brilliant, it's an iconic parody, is to show that by giving factoids out of context, you could make anything, even water, seem scary. And that is exactly what the Food Babe does, is give these factoids completely out of context in order to make azotocarbonamide seem like this scary chemical when in fact it's perfectly safe.
There's a lot of letters in there, so it must be scary. It must be bad for you.
Yeah, yeah. So it's partly the naturalistic fallacy, just trading. It's just fear-mongering. So here are her specific points, other than the yoga mat gambit, you know, which doesn't mean anything. She says the World Health Organization has linked it to respiratory issues, allergies, and asthma. A lot of these points are true but misleading. Related to this is the UK Health and Safety Executive has recognized azotocarbonamide as a potential cause of asthma. So here's what they're talking about. This chemical is used as a blowing agent. It's used to help sealants. Like whenever you seal metal to glass, it's actually in fact used for baby food, you know, sealing baby food jars. And it's used as a blowing agent. So if you're a worker in the factory where this stuff is being, where you can directly breathe in the gas, then it's actually a mild, asthma trigger. You know,
how mild?
It's not that bad. I mean, it's probably not as bad as flour, you know, as the flour that's being used to make the bread. You know, you shouldn't breathe that stuff in either. So
it's true.
Some countries like the UK have in fact banned its use in order to protect the factory workers, not because of any risk to people eating food that's made with it. But the Food Babe doesn't inform her readers of that. She just says it's linked to asthma, but this has absolutely nothing to do with bread. This is just, yeah. So if you're working in a factory and you have asthma, wear a mask.
Water is linked to drowning.
Yeah, exactly.
So not to be ridiculous here, Steve, but if you smell the cooked bread, are you breathing in this chemical?
No. Not at all. I mean, it's, you have to be in the factory in order for this to be
okay.
Any
so it's the
issue.
it's the pre-cooking, pre-delivery phase of the raw dough.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you can have safe working practices where it's not an issue. There's certainly a lot more toxic things used in factories. You know, this is not even a particularly bad substance. It's just something that could be breathed in that could is a mild asthma trigger.
So what's her beef then? I mean, what she just heard about this and that.
Yeah, this is how she makes her living. So here's another point. When a truck carrying azoto carbonamide overturned on the Chicago highway in 2001, it prompted city officials to issue the highest hazardous materials alert and evacuate people within a half-mile radius. Many of the people on the scene complained of burning eyes and skin irritation as a result. Yeah, the pure chemical, when a truckload of the pure chemical spills, you know, you don't want to get exposed to that. That's probably true of anything. Yep. You take just about anything you eat and you take any chemical out of it and you have a pure concentrated form, you don't want to be directly exposed to gallons of this stuff. Sure.
Even peanut butter cups? Come on.
Oh, especially.
Well, I mean, if you pick out any chemical, I mean, you know, yeah. It's a... It says nothing about, you know, again, just trying out of context, trying to make it seem like a scary chemical.
Yeah.
Then she says, when azoto carbonamide is heated, there are studies that show it is linked to tumor development and cancer. Then she gives a reference. Now, of course, you know, you have, this is one of those situations where you have to actually click through to the references. And also you could, you know, if you, which don't support the position that she's taking, but I also, independently investigated that point. Now, it is true that one of the breakdown products from heating is semi-carbazide, which has been known to cause tumors in rats, just like just about everything. You know, I mean, high enough dose, you know, mice will get tumors from just about anything. The question is the dose, right? So always. Here's... yeah, it's always the dose. The mere fact that's, you know, that in a study, mice got tumors when exposed doesn't say anything. But so here's what the most recent review article of this data concluded, that this chemical, this breakdown product, the semi-carbazide, is not classified as to its carcinogenicity to humans. So it's not recognized as a carcinogen. Based on estimates of exposures to infants consuming baby foods, so this is again using the, carbonamide as a blowing agent, with assumption that SCM levels at the 95th percentile of 20 nanograms per gram in all of the consumed ready-to-eat foods, compared with a no observed adverse effect level in developmental toxicity studies, the margin of safety is more than 21,000 times. So, you know, that was a little technical, but the bottom line is that the amount that you're going to get exposed to, even if you're eating this every day, is 21,000 times lower than the amount that has been shown to have any ill effects.
Now, if you were to convert that into bread calories, that sounds like enough food for a year.
Yeah, I mean, even if you were living off a Subway like Jared, you're not going to get exposed to enough of this stuff to get anywhere near a level that's going to have any toxicity. All right, but she goes on. She says, not only is this ingredient banned in Europe and Australia, but you can also get fined $450,000 if you get caught using it in Singapore and can serve 15 years in prison. Again, this is because of the risk to factory workers, not because it poses any risk in food. She has a list of these scary sounding factoids taken out of context. She used that to make a petition for Subway to remove this chemical from their breads. And guess how Subway reacted?
They didn't do anything.
They're pulling it.
They're caving into the petition. Now, you know, you can't really blame them because, you know, kids in school apparently are being told don't eat Subway until they pull the chemical. You know, people aren't going to dig down and get all the facts. They're just going to remember there's something scary. There's some scary chemical in Subway.
It's PR nightmare.
Yeah, it's a total PR nightmare. And they just want to go away. They're just doing damage control. That's it. They're thinking about their bottom line. But this is caving. I think this is food terrorism. That's what this is. Because it is. Because she is attacking a company for using FDA-approved substances well below the allowable limits. The evidence shows overwhelmingly this poses no risk to human health. There's nothing, you know, this is completely safe. And she is trumping up this completely pseudoscientific scaremongering case and forcing Subway, you know, I'm sure that this is hurting their bottom line and that forcing them to change, you know, their practices, not because it makes sense, but just to minimize the damage that she's doing to their reputation.
Steve, you're a total shill for Subway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Subway, as you'll see, Monsanto, the pharmaceutical industry, pretty much anybody who's the target of pseudoscientific fear mongering.
It would be pretty cool, though. I mean, you'd get free sandwiches, you know, with a couple extra
bags
of
chips. Well, that's the thing, Jay. I'm the worst shill in the world because I get paid nothing.
That's right.
You're doing
well,
it hard.
Some would say that makes you the best shill in the world. That's right. It depends on which side you're on.
Steve, you know what I thought about when you're talking about this part about how Subway is forced to kind of change despite the scientific evidence? You remember back in the 80s when the Audi Corporation, Audi Cars, a woman had an accident in an Audi vehicle, and then their lawsuit came up. Unwanted acceleration became the buzz term. And Audi, even though they, you know, had all the science on their side and stuff, they caved and they had to start implementing features in their cars to prevent this unwanted acceleration when all the time.
Not just Audi. It became a standard feature in cars that you can't shift into drive unless your foot is on the brake. And that feature was added to cars to address this completely fictitious phenomenon of spontaneous acceleration, which doesn't exist.
It was driver error.
It was a completely fabricated false claim. And, but it changed the industry just because it's easier to change than to try to educate people about why this is pseudoscience.
Right. And Steve, also, this is going to embolden this gal to more of this kind of stuff. She's going to, who's next on her?
Exactly. You have this essentially unqualified, non-expert blogger dictating food policy in this country based upon these fear-mongering tactics. You know, there is a science-based process. I'm not going to say that regulatory agencies are perfect or they don't make mistakes or there's no trade-offs and, you know, their thresholds are all perfect, but there is a transparent science-based, evidence-based process that they have in place. They spend a lot of time deciding what safety intervals there are in doing tests. And you have this person trumping all of that with just some pseudoscientific nonsense. It really is a scandal. And the media is not telling that story. That's not the narrative that they're telling at all. Their narrative is, you know, this crusading blogger has brought Subway to its knees, not that she's a food terrorist, you know, trumping science with her own nonsense and without the slightest bit of process or expertise on her side. Right.
That's very bad.
Very bad. We have one, Bob, you're going to tell us one positive news item in the middle of this string of not so positive news items.
Yeah, this is incredibly cool. Did you guys know that we're developing a Death Star laser? Are you aware of that?
Death Star laser?
Death Star laser.
Wow. What?
When you say we, Bob, is that what, you and Jay? Or
the Empire.
It's the royal we. I didn't even know we were close to doing anything like that. Well, that's what you may believe, though, if you had read some of the headlines that I've been reading. Here's a couple of them. Petawatt Death Star laser prepares to investigate quantum mechanics, chemistry, and more. Or a U.S.-European scientist at work on real Death Star, real all in caps. So it's like, okay, you know, I understand why they do that. You know, they feel the need to reference Star Wars or Star Trek. It's a total geek click magnet. I understand that. So I don't have too much of a problem with that. Whatever. And I really don't think anyone's going to be seriously thinking, well, maybe some. So I tried to find out, all right, what's really going on here? It's clearly not going to be a Death Star laser that can take out a planet. But so in reality, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California is commissioning the design of a petawatt super laser that they will then build. It's called the High Repetition Rate Advanced Petawatt Laser System. HAPLS. I think they probably could have come up with a better acronym, but there it is.
Hapless.
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 So, yeah,
hapless.
if you walked in front of it, you would be hapless. So the attention.
I'd be like them hapless.
Oh boy. So the attention grabber for me at first anyway was that this is a petawatt class laser. That's that's pretty big. That's 1 quadrillion watts. Clearly incredibly powerful. You know, I tried to put that into perspective. One way to look at it is that that laser has, it's the equivalent to thousands of times the output of the entire U.S. electrical grid, all in just one blast. I mean, just all at once, bam.
Bob, would it blow up a planet?
No, and neither would the Death Star. I mean, that's ridiculous. It would just like bore a hole.
Bob,
why would the whole planet explode?
Bob.
Yo.
This whole news item is a lie. I'm waiting to hear about this cool thing with the guys with the helmets and the control panel throwing the lever and the green lights, and they come to a point and they blow up a planet. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, they come to a point and then create a larger beam. They don't just keep going. They just create another beam.
How did that work?
Whatever. So here's another cool way to look at it. So imagine a 100-watt light bulb, just an average bulb. And if you look at a square centimeter of the surface of that bulb, you're talking about 30 milliwatts. And that's approximately the intensity of sunlight on the Earth. So not too intense. So if you could actually sit on the surface of the sun, whether it's the photosphere or the chromosphere or whatever, that would be about 10 kilowatts per square centimeter. So yeah, that's getting a lot hotter. And so then if you go to the other end of the spectrum, or maybe what you would think would be the other end, imagine a gamma ray burst, which is clearly pretty intense. And with a gamma ray burst, we're talking about a flux of 10 to the 20 watts per square centimeter, clearly gargantuan. But if you could actually focus, and you can, if you focus a petawatt class laser, you would actually create a spot that's 10 to the 21 watts per square centimeter, making it essentially the brightest light in the entire universe. So you're talking about an amazing amount of power here, an incredible brightness. But that's not it. I mean, there are other petawatt class lasers around. That the other arguably even more fantastic thing about this laser is that the actual, duration of each laser beam, each laser blast is only 30 femtoseconds long. And that is just such an amazingly short period of time. We're talking 0.00000000003 seconds. Doesn't do it justice. So this, I came across this one. This was great. So 30 femtoseconds is to a minute as a minute is to the age of the universe. So right. So clearly, you're talking about this tiny, minute fraction of a second here. And all that power is in one of those blasts. So I mean, so what we're talking about is essentially, something that's among the fastest controlled man-made events ever. Incredibly brief. It's not the fastest, but clearly, when you combine the power and the brief duration, it will be in a class of its own when it comes online in 2017. And then if you want even, something a little bit more interesting, this thing can shoot it 10 times a second.
So if we're not blowing up planets, what are we blowing up with this thing?
That's not really for blowing up things, although I would love to
see
that.
Not interested.
Yeah, not interested. But it will be pretty amazing. What they're going to do is they're going to ship this to a facility that's going to be used by scientists all over the world for experiments. So essentially what this thing is going to be, it's going to be like the CERN of laser facilities. All these experiments, all these scientists all over the world. And Evan, what they're going to do with it, they're going to use it for a wide range of experiments, things like physics, biology, medicine, chemistry, quantum mechanics, of course. Where it will really shine, though, is the area of high energy density physics, or extreme states of matter. If you focus this on something, you're talking about the ability to accelerate an electron to relativistic speeds in less than one wavelength. I mean, very quickly, bam, this electron is flying away at relativistic speeds.
Just from a total sci-fi angle, I bet you when they turn that sucker on, Bob, it must have like the best noise.
Imagine. And if it didn't sound cool, I would make sure it sounded cool. Whatever I had to do,
you have to have people just come up with a sound effect for it. It has nothing to do with the actual laser. It's just an awesome Hollywood sound effect. I'm going to come up with one.
So real quick, for the real laser geeks out there, the system, it's kind of like two laser systems in one. It consists of a diode pumped solid state laser. And what that does, it pumps the second system, which is a chirped pulse amplification short pulse laser. And that's the real business end of it. And amazing technology. And I can't wait. I can't wait to see what they do with it, and I can't wait for the Exawatt, of course.
All right, one more news item. This one's a semi-downer, Rebecca, although I think there's a happy ending here about the AIDS denialists being silenced. Or the critics of AIDS denialists being silenced.
By the way around. Yeah, well, you know, there might be a happy ending, and maybe our listeners can help with that. We've talked in the past on SGU about AIDS denialists. They are people who, as a collective, tend to believe that HIV does not lead to AIDS. Some of them also believe that there is no such thing as HIV. Others believe that there is no such thing as AIDS. But all of them together represent a really dangerous pseudoscience. There's very little disagreement amongst scientists today about HIV and AIDS. And we've talked quite often in the past about how present-day treatments for HIV and AIDS have reached the point that a person who is diagnosed today stands a very good chance of living a long and healthy and even, you know, quote-unquote normal life if given the right medication and the right treatment. So that makes it particularly sad that there are people out there that are spreading this idea that HIV does not lead to AIDS, that there's no use taking the medications, that there's no use taking antiretrovirals, things like that. And I mean, it's to the point where it would be laughable if it weren't so horrifically tragic. AIDS denialists, for instance, had a magazine that they used to publish. The magazine folded when all of the editors died of AIDS-related illnesses. It's things like that. So there is a movie that came out in 2009, a documentary called House of Numbers, and you can find it online in full if you wish. If you go on YouTube, you should be able to have no trouble finding the entire documentary uploaded for free. And so this documentary is made by the denialists, so it purports to show that there is nothing to the idea that HIV causes AIDS, that AIDS is not a real illness. Some of the people they interview are prominent AIDS denialists, people like Christine Maggiore, who started her own organization to discourage mothers from taking antiretrovirals in order to protect their children from being infected with the virus. Yeah, Christine Maggiore is in the movie. She died actually the year before the movie ended up coming out. What did she die of? Well, AIDS-related illness, AIDS-related pneumonia at the age of 52. The exact same thing that her 3-year-old daughter died of. So there's a definite death count to the pseudoscience. And this film is really horrible in that it promotes this pseudoscience with not a word of criticism or skepticism. So luckily, though, we have people like Miles Power. Power has a YouTube channel in which he talks about various sciencey and skeptic-y sort of topics, but recently he has devoted several videos to giving a very thorough debunking to House of Numbers. I really can't speak highly enough about his videos. They're very well produced and well researched, and he tears the videos apart bit by bit. For instance, pointing out how the actual scientists who were interviewed for the documentary were completely misquoted, and their quotes were taken out of context. They claimed that they were quite purposefully taken out of context in order to say the opposite of what they had meant.
Yeah, can I say that the film is very deceptive, in that the pseudo journalist is essentially, you know, what some people call jacking off. You guys hear that term?
Just asking questions.
But he's trying to hide the fact that he has an agenda, but he clearly had an agenda of HIV denial. So it's a double deception. And then what you're reporting about how the scientists were treated is in line with that.
What they've done is filed DMCA, basically copyright claims, on Power's videos because he uses clips of the documentary in order to debunk it. YouTube has removed the videos. I think that that's their immediate reaction to any DMCA claim, and they wait for a counterclaim to be filed. I assume that Power has done that, but I...
Wait, did I read just today that he was brought back?
And actually, I'm looking right now, and it looks like they have been reinstated. So it looks like right now, as of this recording, if you go on his YouTube page, you can see the various parts of his debunking of the House of Numbers. And so if you can go on there now and watch them, I think you should, because they're great. Also, there is a petition asking YouTube to reinstate the videos. I'd say still sign it, even if the videos are up, because the last update that Miles gave said that he had been issued another DMCA that had threatened to terminate his entire account within the week. And if that was terminated, then he wouldn't be able to make a new account. And so that's not just silencing these particular videos, it's silencing his voice entirely. And I think it's important that YouTube know that this is not okay. This is not an appropriate reaction to false DMCA claims. And also to let Miles know that his work is appreciated. So you can sign the petition and also subscribe to his YouTube channel for as long as it exists, and maybe encourage him to continue making great sciencey, skeptic-y YouTube videos.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thanks, Rebecca. Well, Evan, it's time to move on to Who's That Noisy?
Okay, Steve, thank you. I'm going to play for you last week's Noisy to refresh your memory. So here we go. Kind of a scratchy little pulsing sound or noise. That Noisy was taken from a video. I want to make sure I get the title of this correct. Bob, you're going to love this. Nanotechnology and Quantum Computing, the Sound of Moving Atoms.
Oh, cool.
Neat.
The subtitle reads, When Atoms Are Displaced and Moved Around by IBM's Nanotechnology, the video was produced by IBM, such movements generates a reverberating sound, much like a scratching, screeching sound. So it's a little 1 minute video just talking about this technology in which they talk about this test they run with a microscope in which there's a needle point that runs a current between the point and the surface of which they're, you know, moving it along. And what happens is as the needle moves, an atom actually follows the tip of the needle as it goes across the surface. And it hits what's known as binding sites. So there are spaces between the binding sites. So that's the pulsing you're hearing, is as that atom moves across from one binding site to another. And very cool stuff.
Yeah,
very,
I like
very,
it.
Yeah.
Very. Who knew that you could actually hear atoms at that moving along a surface like that? That's
it. Has
very,
like a very drum cool. beat to it. You know, it has like a rhythmic drum beat.
Mm-hmm. And there
That's
are
cool.
Yeah, and there are some other examples of this similar technology, not just that IBM is doing, but other laboratories around the world in similar experiments. And they do come up with other patterns to that beat. It's kind of a similar sort of scratching, but yeah, you can go ahead and listen to your atoms. Very cool stuff. No correct guesses this week. It was a tough one, very tough.
The stumper.
Yeah. So this one was the stumper. But that's okay. It happens occasionally, which means we should just get on to, this week's.
All right. What do you got?
All right, guys. This is a good one. Let's see if you can guess who is speaking these, very interesting words. Here we go.
And you show in the kill shot, Kennedy is going back and to the left very clearly. The shot has to come from the front. Because he reacts. He goes back. And there's now they've put scientific coding on it and called it all kinds of things, but that doesn't work.
So there you go. There's a voice you may have heard recently or maybe not, but certainly talking about a specific subject that he's somewhat familiar with. Go ahead and give it a guess. I think we'll get some correct ones. WTN at theskepticsguide.org is the email address for your answers, or go ahead to our forums, sguforums.com, Give it a guess. I want 10,000 guesses this week. Let's see if we can get 10,000 emails and responses on our message board.
Really? You really want 10,000 guesses? Okay.
Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Very interesting year so far. Jay is eking out a lead so far.
Man.
Yeah.
Why do you make it sound like I'm barely there by the skin of my teeth?
You're just slightly ahead of Rebecca right now, who's slightly ahead of Bob and Evan. That's the current stats.
Don't call it a comeback.
But you've never won of the whole year before, Jay, so it's interesting that you're out in the lead.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Yeah. It's early yet.
It's early. It is early. It's just February.
Well, with Christmas going on. Oh.
I have faith in you, Jay. You could do it.
There we go. Thanks. Item number one. Scientists report new evidence that purports to find the missing mass from galaxy clusters, a previous 40% discrepancy between observations and predictions from cosmological models. Item number two, new research finds that people make better decisions when they believe that outcomes are predetermined by fate. And item number three, archaeologists report on the oldest human footprints found outside of Africa from a UK site dated to 0.78 to 1 million years ago, pushing back the earliest known humans in Northern Europe by at least 350,000 years. Jay, go first.
All right, that first one about scientists finding the missing mass from galaxy clusters. From the way I'm reading this news item, they have found 40% of these galaxy clusters or are able to account for it in some way or another. That seems to be significant. That's a lot of missing stuff to find. They must be very proud of themselves. But it's another one. Like, it's hard for me to judge. It seems plausible. But it also seems like a pretty big discovery, and we always say, I think I would have heard of it unless they found, this thing happened over the last few hours. But okay, let me just move on. Yeah, this one about people making better decisions when they think the outcomes are predetermined by fate. That's interesting, meaning that, that people will feel more, I think it means that they feel more secure to make decisions and to move forward and to push forward on ideas that they have or feelings that they have, where if they didn't feel like, fate was driving them, that maybe they would be a little more cautious or scared. So I think that one is definitely science. Okay, and this third one where they're saying that they found footprints 350,000 years earlier than the earliest ones they had found before, and they found these at a UK site. Yeah, again, I think this one is science because I could easily believe that they just found earlier footprints. They were excavating, they found some footprints, they dated them. And I see no reason why people couldn't have made it up to the UK from Africa, roughly 350 million or 350,000 years earlier than previously thought. So therefore, by default, I have to say that the one about the galaxy clusters is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
For me, I haven't heard any of these, so good job on that, Steve. The one I zoomed in on, though, is the idea that people make better decisions when they believe outcomes are predetermined by fate. I mean, I guess I can see this one going either way, but the way I think of it, people are more likely to make bad decisions if they think things are predetermined by fate because, in my head, I can envision thinking, well, I guess it doesn't really matter if I jump off this bridge with a bungee cord because what's going to happen is going to happen. Not to say that bungee jumping is necessarily a terrible decision. Please don't send me your angry emails, adrenaline junkies. But yeah, the idea of like, well, I'm not in control. Whatever is going to happen is going to happen. No need to put money away for the future, for instance, because if God wants me to starve to death, then I'll starve to death. Who knows what's going to happen. I can see the result being poor decisions more often than I can see the result being good decisions. If you didn't think that that your life was predetermined, then that puts more of a burden on you to make good decisions. If nothing you do matters, then you may as well do whatever is fun and just see what the result is. So because of that, I'm going to say that that one's the fiction.
Okay. Evan?
The missing mass from galaxy clusters. Previously 40% discrepancy between observations and predictions. Yeah, I certainly haven't heard this yet. I don't see any problem with this. I mean, it's a pretty big, significant discovery. I mean, closed the gap there. that was pretty significant. So that's what's standing out of this one. Is it too big a deal? So that's an interesting one. The next one, people make better decisions when they believe outcomes are predetermined by fate. All right, so this could go either way. Like Rebecca said, perhaps, you know, people who think that things are predetermined by fate are actually more lackadaisical in their decision making. Therefore, the result would probably be, well, you know, you're spending some of your brain power in a sense, and allowing, you know, what you feel is fate to take over. And therefore you let some of your guard down and that would lead to worse decisions. But, if you have a certain level of confidence in your belief in the fate, that may give your, you know, confidence a boost enough that it actually has sort of this positive effect. That could go either way. And then the last one, the human footprints found outside Africa, up to 1 million years ago, and it pushes back the earliest known humans in Northern Europe by at least 350,000 years. Well, you know, I mean, the oldest human footprints found outside Africa, you know, the world's a pretty big place. Certainly, you know, Africa's just one part of it. So to say that it's found outside Africa, you're covering a lot of area, you know, China and everywhere else. You're limiting it. So, but I don't see a problem with this one either. And I'm going to say people are actually going to make some worse decisions if they go with the fate. So I think that one's going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The missing mass. Yeah, I mean, I've read a fair bit about modified Newtonian dynamics, and they seem to be able to come up with lots of different explanations for, you know, alternative explanations for dark matter. So, and you know, you say there purports to find the missing mass, so it's definitely not clean sweep. It's not definitive at all, and I would be surprised if it was really, really hard evidence. But I could see them coming up with some new way to explain that away. So I don't have too much of a problem with that one. The third one, the footprints. Yeah, I mean, they're pushing back dates every day, 350,000. Yeah, it's a little high, but not terribly high. If it was more like, you know, 500,000, it would be a little more eye-catching. But 350,000, yeah, I mean, I don't have that much of a problem with that. So I could totally buy that one. All right, the fate one, the second one. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Rebecca said about that. I think if you just think fate is in control of everything, then I think it would make you more of a sloppy thinker, a lazy thinker, maybe even more selfish, just going with your gut, on a lot of things and not really thinking it through. So I'm going to say that one is fiction as well.
All right. So we got Jay by himself with the galaxy clusters and then everyone else on the fate, which means you all think that archaeologists report on the oldest human footprints found outside of Africa from a UK site dated to 0.78 to 1 million years ago, pushing back the earliest known humans in Northern Europe by at least 350,000 years. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Hooray.
Hey.
This is cool. So yeah, human footprints are, this is a very, really cool bit of archaeological evidence. And this means that we have evidence for humans in Northern Europe older than any fossils of humans we found in Northern Europe. That these footprints are the oldest evidence of humans in Northern Europe. And these are the oldest footprints found outside of Africa as well. So these were found in Happisburg, UK. This is an early Pleistocene site. And it's multiple individuals of different sizes. So it's probably like a family group with different ages and sexes mixed together. This probably represents the species Homo antecessor, which is essentially a very
Cain
early
comes before.
Yeah, a very, very early human. You know, on the road, you know, this is not a side branch like Neanderthal. It's definitely on the road to directly to becoming human. So Homo antecessor fossils have been found in Spain, for example, so in Europe. So yeah, so pretty cool find.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, I guess we'll keep going in reverse order. Number two, new research finds that people make better decisions when they believe that outcomes are predetermined by fate. Jay thinks this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Sorry, Jay.
Does that mean I've caught up to Jay?
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I think you might.
I
can't
do
closer.
That in my head that quickly.
Yeah, you guys are right. I mean, it makes sense that if people are thinking that their fate is predetermined, that they're not going to think very carefully. But what the research actually showed, the research item that I'm basing this on, is that when people are faced with a difficult decision, they tend to increase their belief in fate. Yeah, so the research did a couple of different studies along this question. This is published in Psychological Science. What the researchers found was that they did a questionnaire where they asked people about their choice between Obama and Romney. And, you know, did they think that both candidates were good, that one was definitely better than the other, etc. And they also included questions about their belief in fate. Fate will make sure that the candidate that eventually gets elected is the right one. So those people who thought that the decision was more difficult because they weren't able to really separate the two also had a higher belief in fate. That I didn't find that compelling. Just because it's, you know, it's just survey questions and there's so many variables in there. But they did a follow-up study, which is a little bit better, where they controlled the information. So they fed people information about Romney and Obama. In one set, the information made their policy seem very similar. They emphasized the similarities in policies between Romney and Obama. In the other set, they emphasized the differences. They made them seem very different. And those people who were fed the similar policy characters, descriptions, then reported a higher belief in fate.
And that fits in with what we know from other studies about superstition, where people tend to rely more on superstition the more things seem like a coin flip.
Yeah.
The more chance there is.
The more stressful it is. Yeah, exactly. So they basically saying, oh, I can't make up my mind. So, oh, whatever. Fate will determine what's the right thing to do anyway.
Yeah.
So that was the hypothesis and the data supported it. Again, I always find this kind of data not extremely compelling because it's so difficult to do this kind of study really rigorously. But, and it's, you know, it's, almost by definition, science or fiction items are one-off studies because I'm reporting on something that was just published, rather than a systematic review, you know, of everything that's been published. But for what it's worth, that's what it showed. And this one's the fiction anyway, so I don't really have to believe the results. In any case, let's go back to number one. Scientists report new evidence that purports to find the missing mass from galaxy clusters, a previous 40% discrepancy between observations and predictions from cosmological models. And this one, of course, is science. But Bob, I got the sense that you misinterpreted this item.
Okay.
This is a complicated one. This is actually not about dark matter. It may superficially seem that it was. But what they're talking about here, the discrepancy they're talking about here is if you look at models of the Big Bang and the early universe, you know, the cosmological models, you know, there were ripples in space-time after the Big Bang, and these ripples in the initial hot plasma that made up the early universe eventually became the galaxy clusters, not just individual galaxies, but the clusters of galaxies were along these ripple lines, right?
Yeah.
Now, the computer models, the physical models that predict that these galaxy clusters should contain 40% more mass than observations indicated was in these galaxy clusters. But these observations were based upon a very specific method. The method they were using is called Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. Have you ever heard of this, Bob?
No.
It's essentially light passing through a galaxy cluster from a more distant galaxy, let's say.
Gravitational lensing?
No. That's lensing is different. So this is the Zeldovich effect is light, like the cosmic microwave background radiation as it passes through the gas in the middle of a galaxy cluster, it will actually get amplified because it will heat up and then get sort of re-emitted even hotter. So the amount of amplification, you can use that to infer the total mass of the galaxy cluster. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but that was the main way they were determining the mass of the cluster. That was there's no other backup methods to corroborate.
Well, the whole point is that's a very unreliable method, and because there's lots of sort of assumptions in there about how much gas is amplifying the background radiation. So the new study that came out used gravitational lensing. So now you're observing a distant galaxy and you're looking at the bending of that light as it passes around the supercluster. And this is believed to be a much more accurate method of weighing the galaxy cluster.
Duh.
And this method, so by the older method, they were finding 40% less mass than what was predicted by the models. But by the newer method, it brings it pretty close to the predictions. So they're finding more mass with the gravitational lensing method, bringing it in line with the previous model. So they're saying we don't have to solve this mystery of the missing mass because there is no missing mass. The mass is there by this more accurate method of using gravitational lensing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's funny though, because this is an example of it's a good skeptical point, because I was – when I read missing mass, I think, dark matter and Mond and stuff. So I didn't even remember the word cluster. I just read galaxy.
Yeah, I
thought
that. Not
clusters, right?
And I was like, totally, when you were answering, I'm like, Bob, it's galaxy cluster, not galaxy.
My filter just completely made that invisible to me. It's so funny. Wow. But it still worked out.
Yeah. Well, basically because you didn't believe it, but I mean, you just said, somebody's claiming it, but it's probably not really true. But anyway, but this is different. Yeah. This is just about the total mass in the cluster, not what is the mass,
Steve, you're saying that I lost this week.
I'm sorry, Jay, you did lose.
Are you sure though?
I know you're not accustomed to this feeling, Jay.
It's very odd.
Let it sink in. Accept it.
But you went first. You took point, so that's always the challenging position.
Yeah, I know. It's the hardest one. Yeah,
but two in a row here,
And you're probably still at least like tied for first with me.
I'm slipping headlong into mediocrity.
It's called regression to the mean, Jay.
Exactly, regression.
That should be
to the
title
mean.
Of your biography. Your autobiography.
Sliding into mediocrity by Jay Novella. All right, well, Jay, you can rescue yourself by giving us a really kick-ass quote.
No, we can't.
DeWald Snyman. Imagine if you're a listener of this show and then for some strange reason, one of us just yells out your name. DeWald Snyman has sent in the quote I'm going to read this week. This is a Daniel Dennett quote, and the quote is, "Ignorance is nothing shameful. Imposing ignorance is shameful. Most people are not to blame for their own ignorance, but if they willfully pass it on, they are to blame." And that is a wonderful quote by none other than Daniel Dennett.
That's interesting. I like that quote. That kind of comes up in the context of the SGU because, we try to make that distinction. We don't really, blame people for not knowing stuff. We're trying to teach them and try to spread knowledge. But when people are willfully spreading misinformation or pseudoscience, those are the people we go after and we're more critical of. And sometimes people feel like we're being mean, but we are making that distinction. We go after Dr. Oz because he should know better and he should have responsibility and he's spreading misinformation. Not people who believe Dr. Oz who, it's not their fault that they're being fed misinformation by somebody who should know better,
Right. Well, we're all ignorant on a lot of things.
Yeah. And more things than we're not ignorant about. Yeah.
Of course. Exactly. Yeah. It's just how do you handle your ignorance and,
I want to point out that by becoming a premium member of the SGU, you get access to our premium content. This is extra content that we generate as a thank you for our supporting members. And recently, for our premium content, we've been doing a series of interviews. So there is an interview there about, these are all over 40 minutes. There's an interview with Jay. And a couple weeks ago, I put up an interview with Evan. This week, Bob and I recorded an interview, and I hope to do the post-production on that and get it up soon. And then we'll do Rebecca, and then Jay's going to interview me. So if you want to listen to these long, in-depth interviews with the Rogues where we get up close and personal, then all you have to do is become a supporting member, a premium member of the SG, or just check out our membership page for all the wonderful benefits you get from supporting the SGU.
And I'm going to channel Perry for an upcoming interview. So we'll get to know Perry a little bit better and how things are going in the post life.
So you just decided that on your own, did you, Evan?
Just now. And it took like a second for me to think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've seen a channeler before, so you can do it.
Absolutely. Right? Oh, come on.
I asked that psychic once about Perry, and she said he was going to have a great year economically.
Of course. Right? Dead men pay no bills.
What was that from? Hitchhiker's Guide to Spending a Year Dead for Tax Purposes?
Yeah, good one, Steve. Well, look at Michael Jackson. His estate's making more money now than he has in decades.
Yeah. Or Tupac.
Mm-hmm. Tupac.
Tupac Elvis, has released more albums posthumously than, what's the opposite of posthumously?
Pre-posthumously.
Pre-humously?
Pre-mortem.
Pre-mortem, yeah.
Honestly.
Don't forget that Nexus is coming up also. We're all going to be at Nexus April 11th to 13th in New York City. Check it out. Lots of great talks. We're going to have some more information coming up. Jay, I believe that there was an update on the stimulus response.
Yeah. So Friday night, we have an awesome show called Stimulus Response, and we have a couple of really cool things happening. There's going to be some very interesting live music being played. More details coming about that, but I promise you that you will know at least one of the musicians that is on stage. The second interesting thing is that last year what the comedy skit people did, the improv group, is they brought me up on stage. They interviewed me for about 15 minutes, and then they took everything from the interview and made a complete mockery of my entire life with, you know, just completely made up routines. And it was awesome. So this year they're going to use Steve as the subject.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm going to be in the hot seat.
I'm going to love watching Steve squirm in that seat as they pick his life apart, and then they're going to make fun of him with live comedy. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I had no part in that decision, by the way. I just want to point that out. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me this week.
Had a big part.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.